It's time for Twig This Week in Google. We've got Jeff Jarvis, Stacey Higginbotham, unfortunately not feeling well, but Mike Elgin sits in studio right next to me. We talk about Google I.O. We talk about some features upcoming from Android Q. We talk all about Facebook. We get in the weeds on Facebook and whether we think they're good or not so good, and we've got some differing opinions on that, and really a whole lot more. Huawei charges, a whole lot on today's show. This Week in Google is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 493, recorded Wednesday, January 30th, 2019. The Dork Face Problem. This episode of This Week in Google is brought to you by DigitalOcean, the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications. Over 150,000 businesses rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. You can sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/twit. And by OnDeck. Are you a small business owner in need of capital today? Well, OnDeck can help. With over $10 billion in loans and an A-plus rating from the Better Business Bureau, OnDeck is a lender you can trust. Find out more at ondeck.com/twig. And by Capterra. Find the right software for your business with over 700,000 reviews of products from real software users. Visit capterra.com/twig for free to find the right tools to make 2019 the year for your business. It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Leo Laporte, of course, out, as I like to say, gallivanting. I'm not really quite sure where Leo is gallivanting this week, but nonetheless, he's gallivanting. I'm Jason Howell, filling in for Leo. Really enjoy being able to hop on Twig while he's out. So thanks for allowing me to join y'all today. Joining us as usual, Jeff Jarvis, BuzzMachine.com. How you doing, Jeff?
Great, great. Leo gallivants, you hop, I sit.
All right. And so what does that mean when Stacy's out and Mike Elgin is in Stacy's place? If we hop, gallivant, and sit, what are you doing, Mike Elgin?
I'm just confused with all the gallivanting and sitting.
Mike is the ultimate gallivanter and world hopper.
Yes. It's true. So
I gallivant to another location, and then once I'm there, I sit.
Yes.
So, I do it all, Jeff.
I was telling you before the show, I am so, like, I respect you so much in your ability to do what you do, to just kind of travel the world and live your life like that. I love it. It's what a wonderful life choice.
The concept of the digital nomad was arrived at in 97, I think, by a Hitachi executive who wrote a book called Digital Nomad. And for a long time, it was just like, oh, that's crazy. Like, why would you do that?
Nowadays, no one does that.
Well, nowadays, it's actually lots and lots and lots of people do it. And it's a technology-enabled lifestyle. We talk about technology changing culture. This is a major way it can change culture, and especially the thing that really kicked digital nomad living into high gear was the sharing economy. Airbnb, things like Uber. Like, you go to Mexico City, which used to be super dangerous to take a taxi in Mexico. Still is to take a taxi in Mexico City. Everybody's like, don't take a taxi. Uber is great. I mean, it's really great in Mexico City. So it's like the sharing economy has really transformed living abroad. It sort of enables you to not have to own stuff. You just rent and borrow and, you know, whatever, share things everywhere you go.
And it feels, and in many cases, I imagine, feels like home, even though you're not, you know, you don't have a home that you return to every single day. You're there long enough for it to feel home. And you're actually living in a home if you're doing the sharing economy. Well, you're living in someone's home that they've built up for you to, you know, to share with you.
We say we feel like temporary locals everywhere we go. Because we go there, we meet the neighbors, we shop in local stores, we sort of get to know the place, and we acclimate ourselves to the point where we just feel like locals, and then we leave.
That's the fun part.
But it's
until the next time.
Yeah, the hardest thing is you make friends everywhere, and then you're always away from most of your friends.
Yeah,
you
know? No
kidding. So it's, you know, but it's worth it because you do make all those friends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Mike, I get this ad on Facebook all this time for the supposedly magic T-shirt that you like never have to wash. Do you own like one of those?
No, because my wife and I, by which I mean my wife, and I, to a lesser extent, just don't like synthetic fabrics. I mean, she just, everything we have is cotton or linen or something like that. So those things are pretty high-tech synthetic things. I'm fascinated by them, but I'd rather just have cotton stuff and wash it.
Yeah.
Because all these places that you're staying, they have washers and dryers, and it's not the, like...
Almost nobody has dryers. That's a very...
Oh, really?
Ubiquitous dryers is a very American thing. Like,
okay.
Washers are everywhere, and then people hang stuff
then
on
you
them.
Hang them. Yeah.
And so, but if, you know, what you're talking about, Jeff, the way they advertise it, they're like, you don't need luggage because you only have one pair of underwear, which never...
Right.
And I'm like, that's quite a sales pitch to say you don't need to pack anything because you never need to change your clothes. It's kind of gross, actually. I mean,
it is, actually. Yeah. And then I have the Facebook ads for the suitcase that you can supposedly, it's a briefcase, it's a suitcase, you can fit everything in. They show you how they get everything. My whole house is in this one little thing.
Turns into a bed. I think
of you when I see that.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I mean, to me, I think the ultimate business, and I think there are things like this, but not quite like this, but I'd love to see some entrepreneur out there, if you're out there listening, a service where you basically have a checklist of stuff. And if it's winter, you're going to be winter somewhere, it's going to be cold. You just checklist all the cold winter stuff and then just like, okay, and here's where I'm going to be. And just have them ship it to you.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't travel with luggage. You can do the discount airlines that charge extra for checked baggage and stuff like that. But you don't have checked baggage because they're going to ship it to you. And then you just ship it back. I don't know if that's feasible financially. I probably am too much of a cheapskate to actually use it. But I think a lot of people wouldn't be, and I think that'd be a great service. It's your own clothes, and just have them just sort of drifting around out there, and they just come to you when
eventually it finds its way to you.
Choners on demand. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Great name for the
wardrobe en route.
That's
or
right.
Something along those lines.
That's right.
There was a story, I feel like this was like 3 or 4 months ago, about a company that was all about digital nomad living.
Mm-hmm.
Where you would sign up with them, someone who had never done it before would sign up with them, mm-hmm. and you know, I guess you'd pay up front a certain deposit or whatever, mm-hmm. and that would get you to your next destination.
Yes.
And something really bad happened with that company. I think it folded, and a bunch of these people ended up getting stranded around the world because
you're thinking about the Fire Festival. No,
it kind of sounds like the Fire Festival now that I'm saying it out loud. But it was a company that was built up and designed for this type of living, and it ended up failing miserably.
Yeah.
But in essence, it ended up totally stranding all these people because they were able to get to their point A.
Yeah.
They weren't able to get back because there was no money to get back.
That's terrible.
It all evaporated.
That's
it's like,
terrible.
What do I do now?
Well, you live in Thailand.
I guess so.
Congratulations. You'll have the king.
But figure it out.
Yeah. But there are all kinds of really interesting and innovative. Innovative. Isn't that how they say it in England?
That's innovative. Innovative.
Thank you, Jeff.
England, yes.
He goes to Europe a lot.
That,
you know, for housing, for example, there's one fascinating one where you sign up and I think you move every month to another member's house somewhere else in the world. Everybody
like
shifts to the left and yeah, but you somebody's staying in your house and move, you know, and there, you know, there's all kinds of different things. The most common are things like Roam, which is like they have locations that they've, I guess, purchased somewhere. And you go there and it's like you're living in a dorm or something. And there's a bunch of people. They seem to skew young. They seem to be geared toward people who are entrepreneurs or whatever because they want to work together. They have fast Wi-Fi and all that kind of stuff. So there's really multiple types of people. The reason it's used to be that you could do this because you had a laptop and Wi-Fi and all that stuff. It was technology. Right? Now that's just banal. Everybody's got a laptop.
Everybody's got it, yeah.
But the reason it's still a tech thing is that the most of the remote jobs are like developers, web designers, things like that. They tend to be tech jobs that lend themselves to you not being
there. To being able to work anywhere as long as you have your computer. Great, you can do 95% of the work that you actually need to do.
And a lot of the software engineering training companies have got on this bandwagon. They have like, you know, cruises and like retreats where you go and you learn coding and stuff like that in Bali or something. And it's cheaper because everything's less expensive there and so on. But there are really multiple kinds. There's like the people who do that, where they go with they always want to be with a group of people and they live together and work together, all kinds of co-working, co-living combined. The second one is which are often called digital nomads, are actually just kind of expats. They go to Thailand, they go to Chiang Mai or someplace like that. There's great infrastructure, very low cost of living, lots of other entrepreneurs around, and they can sort of brainstorm and all that kind of stuff. They're not traveling around. They want a location where they can live inexpensively. in a foreign country. And then there's the people like me who just are always going to different places and not with groups, not with services. We just go. And I mean, I'm biased, but personally, I think that's the way to do it. You just go. Just buy the ticket. First thing you do is you buy a ticket. Then you sell
that,
your house.
That assures that it's happening. You're
exactly. Because you'll be like, someday I'd like to. No,
oh, buy totally.
A buy a ticket,
agree.
Even if it's for next year. Totally buy a ticket. And then the clock is ticking and you'll do it. You know. So I just really believe it. And use Airbnb. Use these services. Yeah. And it's just the greatest thing in the world.
Does any of this news that we're hearing about Airbnb, and I guess we've been hearing about it for the last couple of years, about kind of like cameras in places or insecurity about the place that you're staying. I use Airbnb actually pretty regularly when we go to Tahoe.
Right.
Usually get an Airbnb when we travel, you know, to Oregon, we'll get one. So I have no problems with it. But is that ever, like going to all these different places, is that ever a consideration for you?
Never. I never worried about it at all because it's just an artifact of scale.
Yeah.
They have so many hosts that if you have a million hosts, you're going to have
there's going to be some
stuff.
Bad apples
yeah,
in there.
Just because of the numbers. But I've never encountered anything like that. And besides, if there's a camera somewhere, it's like, so what? I mean, it's like, you know, it's no big, I don't know. I mean, I shouldn't dismiss it if anybody's privacy has been genuinely violated.
Sure.
But it's really not a big factor. Somebody could put a camera in your house when you're not there. I mean,
That's true.
Like lots of things could happen.
we could walk around with a camera in our pocket every single place go in our entire
imagine
lives.
If everybody had a camera in their pocket. Hell, what a nightmare that would be.
Oh, I know. Always on microphone, listening in our kitchen.
Oh, it'd be,
that'll never happen.
Dystopian. but no, it's Airbnbs. The biggest problem with Airbnbs are weird things like, you know, they try to gouge you on stuff. So you get there and they're like, oh, you wanted sheets on the bed? That's going to be $20. And so that happens. So I wrote a book called Gastronomad where we have this whole section on how to do Airbnb well. And there's a whole checklist of things to talk to the host about before you go there. Are you charging extra for this? Are you doing this? Where's the nearest this? Where's the nearest that? And it's like, if you do that, you can really, you know, everything works out great.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. Go through the list.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, do you think you're going to be traveling to Shoreline in a couple of months?
No, I will not. No, I will not.
Your travels are not going to take you to Mountain View?
I stopped going to Google I.O. and other things like that because big conferences like that, I just never got anything out of them, actually, other than the sort of like, look at me, I'm at I.O. I mean, now that's not true for most people because you're like, I'm a writer. So I'm looking for information nobody else has. It's also great to learn things, but you can get all that stuff online. Mm-hmm. In your case, you guys have you're going to do a recording and stuff there, right?
Well, yeah.
That was an RSA.
We haven't.
Twit is doing an RSA thing. With like,
there is an RSA, but yeah, we have absolutely done that the last many years. Like we've done This Week in Google from the Google campus.
Right.
That was a lot of fun. We've interviewed last year, actually, we interviewed some pretty senior Android execs the Google campus.
Is that just last year?
Well, yeah, we did that last year
the
year before.
Right, I thought it was the year before last. That's right, yeah. That was fun. You, Jason invited me into All About Android for that.
Yeah.
And the visuals are great because it's all fun. There's lots of toys and amazing stuff. And I don't know if it's still like that. I know the last one I went to was the last time they were at Moscone.
Okay, so you haven't been to the Shoreline ones yet?
No.
Okay.
I have not.
And I mean,
I've been out of the country each time, and this time I don't know if I'm in the country or not, but I'm not even going to try.
I mean, Shoreline, I.O. at Shoreline feels kind of like music festival sort of thing,
right,
developer conference also. It's got its own vibe.
It's not as
thankfully,
cool.
They've settled in. I feel like they've kind of found their groove there. The first year was a little weird,
a
little hot, cramped, and every year they kind of improve on it. It feels like, it feels like home now for Google.
They improve on the conference part of it, but it's gotten worse in terms of the like junket part of it. So they used to give you I remember what was the thing before the Pixel Book?
The Chromebook. Chromebook Pixel, right?
Chromebook Pixel, whatever it was.
I can't remember.
They gave everybody one.
Yes.
It was
they've definitely.
And here's a Moto 360 watch and a phone.
That's,
they gave you all of those things. Like, wow, this is like awesome. Well,
yeah. I mean, and it was nice to get those things. They've really peeled that back, scaled that back. And that doesn't really happen unless you happen to be in some random announcement. Or if it does, like, I think last year, what did they give out? It wasn't anything.
It was
a Google Home or something.
No, it was. Yeah, they gave out a home. That's easy. And then they gave out that that kit for you to make
oh, the Android
your own
things.
IoT thing.
The Android things.
Android things, kit. Yes.
Right. I was there the first year. They really scaled it back, and everybody was so bummed.
Well, yeah.
They handed out Google Cardboard. And everybody's like, this is it? You're going to give us a little thing.
Meanwhile, that ended up being a really big
movement. Yeah, yeah, it's huge. But then, like, you know, 6 months later, the New York Times was giving them away with subscriptions and stuff like that. Yeah. But it's the junket. And they're smart to do that. You can't.
They are. You know, and I think at this point, people expected a whole lot less. Like, it would great. It's always nice to get, you know, things that seem like they are free. But ultimately, like, for us and for me, yes, having those interviews is a really powerful thing, really awesome thing to be able to do. Networking for the shows that we do, you know, I meet so many awesome developers at Google I/O. Like, cool. Well, you're doing really cool things. Why don't you come on the network and talk about it? Like, you know, we can rap about that.
Yeah.
Why are we talking about Google I/O? Because Google has basically announced, in the way that they do, they posted a video. Filled with all sorts of clues, super cryptic. It was like, solve this puzzle and you might win a free ticket to Google I/O. And so this was going on at the same time. Someone went to a test Twitter page for one of Google's like test accounts and pulled the JSON code from the page and found embedded in the code Shoreline Amphitheater, what is it, May 7th through 9th.
They should give that person...
I know.
Front row
I
seat.
Feel like that kind of qualifies you for
Absolutely.
A free ticket.
Exactly.
You know, you solved the code in a different way, but that's a pretty great way to find out.
Yeah, it's like Ready Player One. You found the key, and like you get the whole company.
So we got
F8's the week before. So that's what that's they've also settled into that routine now.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So it's a full week. So it's F8's in San Jose on April 30 and May 1, and then the following week is I/O.
So it's just a full two.
Did Twitter ever
weeks.
Have a developers conference for the short time that they had the API?
I don't really remember. I'd be surprised if they didn't. But
yeah, I think they did. I think they had one in San Francisco or something like that every year for a while.
But then the developers stopped going because Twitter started closing down their apps.
Exactly.
They're like, well, if you don't love us, we don't love you. Fine. So anyways, May 7th through 9th, that's Google I/O. And we'll certainly be, you know, checking that out. And I'm sure there will be some sort of a live announcement stuff around that. I'm pretty much certain we're going to find out more about Android Q. Have you guys kind of been following?
Yep.
A little bit about that. Little bits and pieces about Android Q that we know now. Even though there is no public official release of Android Q, apparently XDA developers got a hold of a pre-release version of Android Q. Who knows how old it is, how current it is. But, I mean, if you're following last year's timetable, we still wouldn't even know about the next release until... I think like 6 weeks from now, so which isn't that far away actually, but still it would be early for us to know at this point in time all about this new version based on previous timetables. But
on All About Android, you guys were talking about what dessert starts with Q.
Yes. Oh, do you have an opinion?
I do.
Okay.
So
of course you do. Gastronomad.
Exactly.
You know this.
Yes.
This is your
quince.
Spot.
Quince.
Okay.
Is a fruit, but they make a like a paste out of it, and sometimes people have that after dinner as a kind of dessert. It'd be a terrible idea. Well, which is to say...
Which is perfect for Google.
Which is to say, naming operating systems after desserts is a terrible idea. I mean, they're getting to the end of the alphabet here pretty soon.
I know, right?
But
So it's a big yellow... It looks like a pear.
It's in the apple family.
Okay.
Okay.
It's an astringent fruit.
It'd be hard to make a statue of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially since it would look like an apple and... You wouldn't want to do that,
right?
Considering
this is the very first version of Android.
But see the brick of orange of the orange there. If you're watching the video,
down below.
Yeah,
So it's like I've encountered it in Italy, France, and Mexico. Mexico recently, actually.
Okay.
But it doesn't have. A lot of sort of recognition.
Definitely doesn't have the recognition. The problem is there are no real Q desserts or treats that have recognition. Most of them are very exotic sounding.
Right.
Exotic too. that's here in the U.S.
You guys were speculating about Nestle's Quick.
I mean, that's a brand that could work.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of consider like a quick drink to be dessert-like.
Yeah, and they may do that just out of desperation.
Because they have no choice.
Nothing
and
else.
Nestle's sitting there going, yeah, what you got, Google?
That's
bring it.
That's right.
Let's make a deal.
They have a really big advantage in the negotiations on that one. We're the only thing with sugar in it that starts with a Q.
I the only one I'm seeing, so The Verge tried to speculate, there's absolutely nothing. The closest you can get to is quiche.
That's quiche not a dessert. That's like a,
I mean, are there dessert quiches, though? Like,
no.
I've had plenty of quiche.
It's, by definition, a savory,
yeah,
you know, unsweetened egg pie, yeah, or whatever.
Yeah,
egg pie.
Yeah, and that's it.
There is a sweet vanilla quiche recipe from Serious Eats.
Okay.
There's 10 best dessert quiche recipes at Yumly. You got to open up your perspective here. Is there a candy
like
that starts with a Q?
There's also frozen ice cream tacos, but that's not like you're not going to. It's not really.
Everything's
a real thing.
Been done.
Serious Eats can't possibly be serious about
everything
that.
In the world has been done, whether it's good or bad. The point is, do you name your operating system after that random thing?
Yeah.
And I don't know. Like this is going to be interesting. One thing we were speculating last night is, what if they just like they overshadow it entirely and they go Android X or something like that?
Right. Right.
Make the shift, you know,
to the Apple model. Yes.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's entirely possible.
Another one is they may name it Quick. Somebody invented dessert that starts with Q.
Right.
That's the name of the operating system.
Right.
That would be.
Google comes up with its own dessert.
That's right.
And names it something that starts with the letter Q.
Yeah.
But apparently, according to the kind of pre-release version that XDA got a hold of, some of the features that you can look forward to, improvements around face detection. So right now we have face detection in Android, but it's a very, I would say, rudimentary kind of
approach.
Are
you using it?
It's been around for years.
Either
I don't use it. No.
I don't use it. I didn't even try it.
Yep.
You know, and there've been time after time where it's been proven that you can take a photo and you can trick it, and I mean, they will spin it and say, "Well, we're doing all of these things with artificial intelligence to blah blah derpader."
Right. Well, a lot of companies are just coming up with something that appears to work.
Right. Because Apple has
like OnePlus has their facial recognition. You can just take a photo and hold it up, and boom, you're in.
Yeah.
And so you know that's not. You know, Google wouldn't do that. I don't think they would be dumb enough to do something like that. It would have to be real.
Yeah, I was actually reading on your site last night. You had a post about OnePlus and all the reasons why you would not buy OnePlus. And I thought your notes on the face recognition was interesting. That they, you know, it's fast. Yes, that makes it seem to a user to be a really great solution. But that's because they're totally bypassing the security model.
That's right.
It's in order to do that,
actual security.
Oh.
It just feels like security.
Right.
And the unaware user is just going to be like, oh, look, this is just like an iPhone. No, it isn't at all. I mean, iPhones is real security, and it's pretty hard to fool. It can be done. Mm-hmm. But that's not the way to go. They're going to do the real thing, and they're going to have, you know, the super radar and all that kind of stuff. And I think Google is actually innovating a lot, like Project Soli. I don't know if we've ever talked about that. But they're doing a lot of innovation on micro radar, and I think that would be a good application already. I mean, if you go to my Twitter account, you'll see the picture that I took in the studio before the show. That was done with the Google Fi's, you know, you smile and it takes the picture. So you go into the studio thing and you basically say, okay, don't take a picture until somebody smiles, and then you smile and it takes a picture. It's so fast, and I did it from pretty far away.
Hmm.
It's amazing what it's doing.
There it is.
Yeah.
Set it up, stood in front of it, made sure you were frowning the whole time.
And I smiled and instantly
and then,
took a picture. And it works flawlessly every time, as far as I can tell. Think about how subtle that is to be recognizing the facial expression of somebody in a photo. So they have a lot of AI.
What it says is there's the dork moment.
Yes.
When you have the smile you only have for cameras, right? If I watch people taking selfies, right? There's this, they turn from sour face, oh, I'm bored being here.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
And then back. There's kind of that dork moment.
Right.
Remember when one of the memes we had was that I'm going to get this confused. You convinced people that you were taking a still photo and then you actually videoed getting ready looking like a dork.
For comic effect.
Right, so you get into picture dork mode, right? And Google, this is the power of Google.
they know when you're being a dork.
Yes, because that's their people.
And, totally.
But there's another side to it, Jeff, which is that this thing, you can just leave it on and it'll keep taking pictures every time somebody smiles. So what you can do is you can prop it up and then just forget about it. And then when people smile genuinely, you get photos of people smiling genuinely. And that's something I think I haven't heard a lot of people doing. But that's, I think, a way to get around the dork face problem.
Right.
But anyway, it's amazing. They have the technology to do this, and I'm glad to see it actually.
I really like the dork face problem dork as face a title.
The dork face problem.
It's a start. You know, we can come up with something maybe better, but I like that as a start.
Yeah,
it's a problem that Google really needs to tackle, the dork face problem.
Yes.
If you hadn't heard, as far as Android Q is concerned, a lot of focus on permissions. So, and permissions have been a thing already. What's the difference here? Just really kind of, I think, getting deeper into permissions and also clarifying it too. I think there's going to be some cleanup of how permissions are served up to users, how it's shown on the permissions page to make a lot more sense than it is right now. Now you get like this wall of switches.
Right.
And it can be a little confusing. And as we know, permissions are actually very important to personal privacy and understanding how your phone is, potentially harvesting data on you at all times.
Yeah.
So good moves. I mean, there's a bunch of stuff. We don't have to dive into them individually, but definitely focusing on improving permissions for the average user.
Yeah. And the audience for this netcast are the super people who are really paying attention to what Google's doing. And so one thing to look for, which I think is the most interesting thing about new operating systems coming out, a new version of Android coming out of Google over the next 3 years, is they're going to be nudging us toward fuchsia. Mm. And fuchsia is really interesting. My theory about fuchsia is that years and years ago, they said, you know what, we really should unify Chrome OS and Android. We should unify them. And we should make it both work sort of like each other and have, eventually end up with one. And I think they thought that all the way through and said, you know what? If we try to actually merge them, we're going to have a mess. We're going to have Windows 10 or something. Windows 7. It's going to be a nightmare of spaghetti code and mismatch. How should an operating system of the future be? And I think that's probably where Fuchsia came from. And they seem to be building this operating system that's going to be, it's going to be for IoT devices all the way up through enterprise clients or servers, who knows. And it's going to have completely different models for how it works from today's operating system. For example, it'll have the Chrome extension-like feature. We talked about this on the show. I think you were on it, Jeff. You weren't on it. But the thing that's interesting about Chrome extensions is they are features that are divorced from apps or applications or anything like that. Mm-hmm. They're features that are applied across different places. Fuchsia is going to work like that. So you're basically going to have, I want the spell check feature. And it won't be spell check for Google Docs. It'll be spell check for everything. Anytime you have words on your screen, the spell check will apply to it. So the features will be a la carte. And so that's just one of 100 different strange things that Fuchsia will likely be able to do. But I think that as over the next 3 years, both Chrome and Android will get Fuchsia-like features. Because
to soften the blow. Get us used to it.
Exactly.
And then also,
at some point in a couple of years, I think they're going to figure out how to get developers to write things that work on Android and also Fuchsia. So that once they throw the switch, your existing apps will just work on Fuchsia. That's just a theory. I have no reason
to
do that.
There is some sort of cross-platform aspects of it already, I remember correctly.
Well, Fuchsia does run on a Pixel phone.
Yeah, right.
And it runs on a Pixel book. So Google's own hardware already runs Fuchsia. Of course, Fuchsia doesn't do anything right now because
it doesn't have any apps.
Apps, and it's not even complete. It's really
it's been earlier days, but it's still early days.
But you see where it's going, and they're using their own platforms as sort of clearly as the growth platform where they're going to start this thing, and it's just going to be fascinating. The rumor is that they're going to go live in 3 years, which means 5-6 years. in real life, probably.
Yeah, I think it was like a couple of years they were saying there was a report that said within the next 5 years. Yeah. And that still felt pretty quick.
Aggressive.
Considering what the goal is. And I don't even know if that's not Google's stated goal, right? Like, that's just kind of what we've come up. They've been very cagey about it.
Very.
But we're all kind of left kind of grasping at straws going, well, what is Fuchsia? They're public enough about it that we know it exists.
Right.
And that, you know, like the news this week, Bill Stevenson, a 15-year Apple senior manager who actually oversaw the launches of all different versions of macOS, Lion through Mojave, is now joining Google. He announced on Twitter that he's going to be he's going to, quote, help bring a new operating system called Fuchsia to market. Stay tuned. So, I mean, in some ways, you know, it's not super secret.
Right.
We just have no, and we've actually seen it operate and seen it in operation. We just have no idea.
What terrifies me? I'm excited because here we are, three Chromebook users.
Normally, right now I'm using an iPad. I think.
Traitor.
It's Megan's iPad. We're doing the Switch. I can't wait to get my Pixel Slate back. Standard comment about that.
I'm worried about you.
You're going to make
but
I hope so.
And they've gone, I think, as far as they can go. It's still, I mean, I've complained on the show before that if something needs any kind of content rights management, it doesn't work. So Netflix is really flaky on my Chromebook Pixel. The apps are awkward. You know, it's better, but it needs a new OS. Yes, it needs something new to bring it together. My fear is how much rewriting of apps is going to have to be out there, and how long it's going to take. You know, will Netflix say, "Oh, not big enough market. Who's on Fuchsia?" And we have to wait forever. That's the awkward transition time.
Yeah, absolutely.
My fear is that we all think they'll do the thing that we want them to do, which is. Create a combined thing that will be a replacement. But then I remember, wait a minute, this is Google we're talking about. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They are a company that they close the thing you don't want them to close, and then they leave open the thing. And they, you know, how many communications platforms do they have right now? I mean, they just keep adding things. So one distinct possibility is that they will never kill Chrome or Android, and Fuchsia will exist, and now...
We just assumed this would be really great for your refrigerator, for your connected refrigerator. That's why we built Fuchsia.
We had too many developers on Android, and we wanted to give some half of them someplace else to go.
Right. Yeah. It's a 20% mm-hmm. project. Yeah. I guess we'll find out someday. I feel like we're going to be talking about this with lots of guessing for a long time before we actually know. But I do think that there's some there's some trickles, some nuggets there, knowing that Bill Stevenson and his background is being brought onto the team. That feels like progress, right? Like he's overseen the launch of major OSs.
Yes.
So there's some dedication, there's some confidence there as far as Fuchsia is concerned. I don't know how many engineers. I think the last time I saw in a report, it said somewhere around 100 engineers, more than 100 engineers, which
sounds
light.
Yeah.
Light for a whole damned OS.
Yeah. Yeah. So who knows?
But, you know, it's funny about that is that it wasn't that long ago when we got all excited on shows like this that a new version of an OS was coming out. So finally, we talked about Q, but it's a bit of a shrug. The OS in a web world, the OS just isn't as important as it was in an app and web world.
And as far as Q features are concerned, like, you know, also keep in mind, like, that's based on a very early leak of the OS.
Right.
In a month or two, when they actually do their official unveil of the alpha or whatever it is, the do not for any reason install this on your phone if you plan on using your phone every day version, they'll probably have some more. But I think that what we know now, the grander kind of approach, the grander kind of point is better permissions management as a really big core feature.
Right. And that sounds to me like a much more interesting rumor than the Face ID type stuff, to use Apple's branding, simply because... The really big news would be if they came out with another version of Android that didn't have it. I mean, that would be amazing. Like that would be such a big story. Headline: Google fails once again to come out with a standard feature that every phone should have. And I think that's a solid one because they got to do it. You know.
Yep. Got to do it.
Let me just say one thing. I said this a little bit last week, but we've got more and more of this. Google, do not force me into dark mode. Do
Do not make me turn off dark mode and find some damn switch somewhere and because you think it's good for me.
Or you're going to learn about Jeff Jarvis's dark mode. And you're not going to like
yes.
It. I'm witnessing right. it right now. I'm scared.
That's right.
Dark mood with dark mode.
Don't dark me, bro. Yeah. Don't dark me. Well, I mean, that is one of the features that we're hearing about with Android Q is that there would be a system-wide dark mode. But I don't know how that's going to work. Like, if that's going to be, like, obviously all the system elements would have a dark mode component.
Yeah, right.
But we also know that Google's been doing a lot of rebranding or redesigning around its apps and making them super bright and then giving you the option for dark mode. Because let's be real, a lot of people really want a dark mode. It's better for battery. It's better on the eyes at night. All these different reasons. I understand. I understand your dark mood, Jeff.
I think that they have so many, they must have so many customers that are Star Wars geeks. They should call it Dark Side.
The Dark Side.
Yeah, that'd be so much better.
That's true. Oh. I mean, it wouldn't be without precedent. Android. I mean,
you don't know the power of the Dark Side. It's like so pleasant to use on a Chromebook Pixel.
Use the Dark Side, you get more power because your battery lasts longer.
That's right.
Let's take a break. Thank the sponsor, and then we'll talk about more. Maybe we'll, who knows, maybe we'll talk about the redesign of Gmail or the ongoing saga that is, why did they take away Inbox? But first, I know, I'm still so sore about this. First, this episode of This Week in Google is brought to you by DigitalOcean. DigitalOcean provides the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications using droplets. It's virtual machines that are a scalable compute platform with add-on storage, security, and monitoring capabilities. So you can choose, if you're a developer, you can choose from standard or CPU-optimized droplets, and then, of course, customize from there and make it your own. DigitalOcean is designed for developers. They have an easy-to-use control panel and an API that lets developers spend more time coding, doing the things that they love, and less time managing their infrastructure, which can be kind of ho-hum. Also, you get industry-leading price-to-performance. You can access the compute resources that you need at the lowest rates. That's going to save you up to 55% compared to other cloud providers. And you'll always know what you'll pay per month because DigitalOcean has a flat pricing structure across all data center regions. And you get a whole lot more added at no additional cost. You get 99.99% uptime SLA. You get cloud firewalls, monitoring and alerting, full DNS management, global data centers, enterprise-class SSDs, an easy-to-use API, of course. Over 150,000 businesses, including some of the world's fastest-growing startups, rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. So you can sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/twit. That's do.co/twit for a free $100 credit, and we thank DigitalOcean for their support. I'm realizing we can't jump to Gmail. That's part of the changelog.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I guess we could. We could break it out of the changelog. Have you guys seen the new?
No, it's not going to be as good as Inbox.
That's the problem. It's
getting darker.
So I feel like everybody who's an Inbox user is in a couple of camps as far as like strategy moving forward.
Yes.
You've either decided that Google's already made the decision, it's time to cut the ties and get used to Gmail now, which is what I, for some reason, decided to do.
I did that too.
Or you're hanging denial. On until the very last day.
That's what I'm doing on Google Plus, yeah. they're killing, no matter who you are, they're killing something dear to you.
No kidding. Yeah. Why do you do this to us, Google?
Because it took so much to get used to it. It took so much to kind of see the wisdom of it.
Yeah.
But when I did, it's like you had me join a cult and then you closed the cult clubhouse.
Actually, we're closing the door.
It seems clear that Google doesn't fully appreciate the value of super passionate users because they create these new things. The people who embrace new things and quickly master them, the early adopters, these are the most passionate users. These are the Google fanboys. These are the, you know, diehard people who make it all work. And they keep coming out with something really cool, getting people invested in it, and then killing it. And it's the really passionate users just feel like they get hammered and hammered and hammered every time they close something, starting with Google Reader all the way through all the rest of it. And it's just they need to stop doing that.
What do you miss most about Inbox? Now that you guys have switched over to the dark mood side,
what will we miss about Inbox?
No, since you've already started making the transition back to Gmail,
yeah.
What do you? I haven't yet.
Yeah.
what was the hardest part of the transition? What are you missing about Inbox?
Probably the what do they call them? Reminders that are integrated into the thing where you can have a what do they call them? The little finger with the string on it icon.
Yeah, I think they were reminders. Man, I did not use that as much.
I use that a lot.
I don't either.
And now I'm back on Gmail, and now I'm just sending email to myself and using the snooze button because I use email. I use Gmail as my universal everything tool. And so instead of having a to-do list, I just have. Essentially, it's a procrastination list. It's like, I can get away with not doing this until March. You know, so like just
leave myself a note. Send it into
the future, and it doesn't come back. And so that's what I do. So Inbox was designed for that. Gmail is not designed for it. I'm just sending email to myself, and it's I feel like a savage. Whereas with Inbox, it was like built into it, which those items would show up in Google Keep. Mm-hmm. They would show up in Calendar. It was integrated with everything. It was a good use case for that. On the other hand, they've integrated a lot of Inbox stuff
and they continue to.
I'd love to see them go all the way because there are.
Yes, I would too.
I mean, the truth is that I could never fully just use Inbox. I was always going back. I like to build filters.
You had to go into Gmail to do the filters to any sort of deeper degree. And you had light filtering capabilities in Inbox.
Right. But I always thought they were going to kill Gmail and keep Inbox.
Yeah.
And I worried about that because one of the things they didn't have or don't have in Inbox is the all mail folder.
Mm-hmm.
So all mail in Gmail just shows you everything. Your
it's so noisy.
Mails, like everything, the spam, everything. But like sometimes you. Did somebody send me something? I don't know where it went. And you can go into all mail and say, you can just go down and say, well, there it is. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas with an inbox, there is no all mail.
You're doing a lot of scrolling.
Inbox is kind of like, trust us. We put everything in the right place. Don't worry about it. And you're like, not really.
Yet at the same time, that is the thing that I miss most from Inbox is the smart bundling.
Yeah.
The bundles.
Yeah, that's what I'm dreading.
The updates
and low priority.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like twice a day, I could just look at that and I could scan down and boom.
Absolutely.
All gone.
I mean, I waste so much time filtering through all of this stuff that would have ended up in that low priority folder.
Yep.
And if I was in Inbox and it's all automatically, filed into this low priority folder, I look through, be like, nope, there's nothing in there. Single check mark, move on with my life.
Yeah.
In Gmail, it just gets interspersed in, and I guess I could set up a folder for each and every one as they come through. But let's be real, that takes a lot of time in Gmail.
And that's
why you want the smart company with all this freaking AI, and they're taking it away from us.
And Inbox is really good also about creating simple filters.
Yeah.
Like I like Gmail's advanced filters if I want to set up something that's really smart. But if I'm in Inbox and I assign this to that category, and I say, oh, this falls into the finance category.
Right.
It'll give me a little toast message that says, do you want all future messages from this address to go there?
Yeah.
Yes. Boom. Filter set up. I don't have to think about it. It was a single button press. If I want to do that in Gmail on every single new email, new recipient or whatever, it takes forever. It's so annoying.
The best thing they could do is create a mode, a toggle switch they could call it something like smart inbox. And just click it on, and then Gmail becomes Inbox for those who choose to do that. And that would hold us all for a few years while they fully integrate them into one super email thing. But if they kill it without integrating those features into Gmail, it's going to be
that's what they're
going
to do next month or in March, right?
Well,
I'm holding on to the last minute.
I'm delusional enough to think maybe they'll just integrate all these things at the last minute.
Yeah.
Probably won't.
Mike,
you're going to get that. And you're going to get an RSS reader at the same time.
Embedded into your Gmail.
Yeah, a new social network. Yeah. That's right.
the new Gmail RSS reader.
That's right. And it's all going to be one thing.
Plus.
In your inbox. Right. RSS in your inbox along with your email.
Hey, I'll
not
take
confusing
it.
At
I'll
all.
Take it.
Yeah, that might actually be a good use case. I'm holding out hope that they eventually do. I have to imagine that Inbox, as Google has said, was enough of an interesting kind of like insight into its users and their priorities. And they used it as an experimental foundation for email. How could you then get rid of Inbox and say, we're going to take the best features from Inbox and move them over to Gmail and not do the smart bundle? Because I have to imagine that saved everybody a lot of time.
Yeah, absolutely.
So do it.
That was the first email feature that made zero Inbox a reality for lots of people, and you know, generally doable.
Everybody except more of a reality.
Yeah. You are Superman, Elgin. You are you travel the world and have an empty email box. How do you do this? I don't know.
I don't even know. No, no, no. I do have I go zero inbox every day, but I do it the hard way in Gmail. I literally create a filter for everything. So every new PR company that contacts me, I go and create a filter by hand to say, anything coming from this company, put it in this folder. And so I have 750.
I was going to say, how many filters do you have?
Then you have to go through all those folders.
Holy cow. Yeah.
I have a gazillion. I have a PR Flack, not Flack, I'm sorry, PR Professional folder. I got alerts folder for like just information. Stuff like I got a bunch of them. So the stuff that comes into my inbox, I've written about this. Like my approach to email is like, can treat every incoming email as a problem to be solved. So like, how can I not get this anymore in the future?
Yeah.
And so like, unsubscribe or route this into a filter and skip the inbox or do something, take some action. Sometimes it's like, well, I need to get these in my inbox. Okay, and I move on to the next thing. But if you are always chipping away. I spend so much time in email.
How much of your time is spent setting up filters, though, and stuff, and responding? Because that is not like we've said a few times. That's not a quick process.
Right. I spend 10 or 15 minutes a day, probably, every day.
Wow.
I just do it as part of my process.
Yeah.
But I do get to zero inbox every day, and I use the snooze button for lots of things. So I feel like I'm a master procrastinator, if you will. Procrastinators, leaders of tomorrow.
Nice.
And I'm always pushing things to the last minute.
Yeah.
Because as a journalist, deadline's the only thing to get me moving on something.
Sure.
So I just push everything to the last minute. And so everything's coming in. It's a battle. I'm just like swatting at flies or something.
Oh, but it feels like a defeating battle if you're constantly setting up filters for every new thing. Like I just think about the like marketing or PR contact lists that I'm on.
Yes,
that will always every day result in new emails from people I've never heard from before.
The thing that confuses me is that what I'll do is when I get something in my inbox, it's like a PR person reaching out as they do, and then I create a filter that says everybody from that company, everybody with that domain. I get rid of the front part because I don't care who from the company
contacted me. Right, it's just everything at the last part. Yeah,
and so, that makes sense. So I've come to the conclusion that five or six new PR companies are formed every day, right? Because I've been doing this for years, and they keep coming. It's insane how many there are.
But they're so effective. Isn't that effective? That's effective right there. It really gets your attention. You are guaranteed to reply to their inquiry when they hit you over the head with a baseball bat like
that. Yes, dear influencer.
Did you guys read the article by Kashmir Hill on Gizmodo? Her series is great. It's basically cutting out the big five from her life one week at a time. Every week she chooses a new technology company to eradicate from her life and see how life is lived without it.
Right.
This week that she wrote about was Google, of course.
Right.
And it's just an interesting read if you want to kind of get a sense of just how embedded. We already know Google is super embedded into pretty much everything on the internet. But it's just a really fascinating read because she and I think her producer created a VPN that blocked, what was the number, 8,699,648 IP addresses that are all controlled by Google.
Yeah.
So basically, at its base, blocked those IP addresses so that any services, be it cloud, be it maps, all of it, just won't work.
Yeah.
To try and live life on the internet without any sort of touching of Google services, and it's basically impossible.
Is impossible.
My favorite part was that there was something that I forget what it was, but she couldn't do it because the company presumed that if she didn't have a Google address, she was a bot or a spammer.
Right. That's how you prove you're human.
Is humanity. Right.
That's what it is to be human, is to have a Google account. But you know, to me, the takeaway from that whole exercise was how incredibly valuable Google is. I mean,
that's
she's
true.
Okay. She, you know, she's like, oh, how do you know, it's so terrible that they track us so much. It's so hard to be untracked and all that kind of stuff. And then once you do it, it's like you can barely function. Why is that? Because we've all gotten used to the power of all these Google services and so on.
And there are reasons these things exist. They're not just to track you and surveillance and all that. It's to make the things function.
Yeah.
Because Google knows you. Mass media knows you as a mass. Google knows you as an individual and a human being. Right. Google is more respectful of your humanity than mass media that complains about Google is.
And that's not to say that that applies universally across all the companies she's trying to remove herself from. Amazon, for example, if you are patient and can wait longer than overnight for shipping, you can just buy stuff all over the place. It's harder. You're constantly entering a credit card. There are solutions for that if you have, you know, using Chrome extension, stuff like that. But basically, Amazon is extremely replaceable. But Google isn't. Mm-hmm. I think Facebook is somewhere in the middle. It's kind of replaceable.
She said she missed Facebook.
Yeah, she missed Facebook. And, you know, Facebook just makes it super easy to stay in touch with people. But you can still stay in touch with, because I'm on this big project to quit Facebook, and I'm dragging it out. So I'm doing it in July. But until then, almost every day, I'm dissing Facebook on Facebook. And I'm trying to get everybody to sign up for my shared folder on Google Photos as my replacement for Facebook.
Okay.
And it's going to take months to do that. And I'll probably get... I'm hoping for half to three quarters of the people on Facebook to actually follow my folder. And
so that they can, instead of finding your photos and your updates on Facebook, they'll just be subscribed to your Google Photos
That's
feed.
Right. And of course,
anything you throw in there.
Everyone's a Google Photos user already for the most part. And you don't have to be a Google Photo user or have a Google account. Even Cashmere Hill can see my photos.
Yeah. Right.
Because you don't have to log in. Just as long as you have the link, you can see it, which means that Google Photos has three times the number of people as Facebook. Hmm. Right? So that's not exactly accurate, because you can also see, I think you can see a Facebook post if you don't have a Facebook account.
You can. Yeah, if you're not logged in or whatever, and you go to a post.
Notifications.
Right.
And notifications are the key. So if you're following a folder, you can choose to get notifications pop up on your phone or not. You can choose to get email notifications or not. Email notifications have a link directly to the photo or to whatever you're doing. You can like things. You can comment. You can do all that kind of stuff. It's not quite as good as Facebook in terms of the elegance, but it's close enough, and you don't have to deal with all the other crap on Facebook. And so it's a way to do it. So there are ways to replace Facebook that if people would think about it a little bit, they would see that it's not as bad as what Cashmere's going through. Because she's just cold turkey, and now there's a void where there used to be Facebook.
It's gone. What do you do now? So I had stepped away from Facebook about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And I think over the course of that first year that I was away, I never logged in.
Well, you look younger now.
Thank you.
It's just
let me tell you, it's improved my life immensely.
Yes.
Time is ticking backwards now. The second year, I think I logged in like maybe five times for different random things. About 40 days ago, I started the 30-day countdown, and I did the delete my account.
Yeah.
I have not checked it since. I'm afraid to try my login credentials because I'm afraid for it to be like, oh, actually, it didn't happen, and now, yay, we've got you.
Yes.
So supposedly, my account is deleted now, but I have not checked it.
Yeah.
And I don't know why it took me 2 years to do it. I stepped away, and then I did nothing, and now it's deleted.
Right. I mean, you know, if you can successfully step away, if you're an alcoholic and you successfully not drink, even though you work in a bar, great.
Great. Good job.
But it's probably a good idea to quit your job and get another job somewhere that isn't a bar. Anyway, so yeah, exactly. And I think everybody's contemplating it. I'm trying to convince people that it's such an unethical company. They really are not helping the world by participating in it.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, people are like, they can't imagine.
What else? Yeah. What is the alternative? Yeah, that is always like the...
My moment of full disclosure is that I raised money for my school from Facebook. I'm independent of Facebook. I received no money personally from any platforms. But I, you know, I generally tend to defend the internet. And I had this argument today. So I was on a CNBC online show called Fort Knox, which I'll put up the link shortly.
today and with Farhad Manjoo from the New York Times, because he was doing the same thing about Twitter. Not saying to kill it quite, but all but.
Yes.
And as I wrote that, I wrote a piece about that, and that's why I ended up on this. I do have to say that there is a point of privilege. And even Siva Vaidyanathan, who's the most firm critic of Facebook I know, has written books against Facebook. Even he cautions that quitting Facebook is something that's frankly fairly easy for us three white guys to do.
Yeah.
That is not necessarily in the cards for people who live in countries where it's the internet and there's other issues that come along with that.
Sure.
Or B, come from underrepresented communities whose concerns are not being covered in newsrooms on cable TV and newspapers, because there's very few people in the newsroom who look like them and experience what they experience. And Facebook and Twitter and Reddit and Instagram and so on and so forth have given people a voice and a platform that they and their communities have never had.
I would agree with that to a certain extent. Like, those kinds of platforms have given voice, but I think you don't need Facebook specifically if you're using Reddit, Twitter, etc., which I would recommend. People are like, oh, they all do it. No, they don't. I mean, no, they don't. It's night and day. The ethical transgressions by Facebook are orders of magnitude greater in number than any other platform that I'm aware of. And once you list them and look at the list, I mean, Google is guilty of tracking and a few other things. Places like Reddit is both super valuable and kind of annoying because they're exclusionary unless you're part of the club and you've built up your points kind of stuff. Twitter has its problems. We've talked about a lot on this show. But come on, Facebook, their latest thing where even Apple has cut off Facebook from using the internal version of the app. I don't know if you saw this story. Mm-hmm. It kind of broke today, I think, Jeff, where they're paying teenagers to let them spy on their usage so they could spy on consumers through the phones of teenagers. It's just yet another egregious abuse by Facebook. And then they apologize and they, say they're going to reverse course. But it's just, just the number and scale of their ethical lapses is just, I got to believe that for everybody who cares and wants to make the world a better place, find another platform or two.
But I'm still going to object again there. It's we tend to see, we miss the trees for the forest, the opposite of the usual.
Yep.
Right? We see this as the company. There's 2 billion people there. And so when Farhad complained about Twitter, and, there's some bozos, I said, well, then don't follow the bozos. Well, it's the same people I always see. Well, then find new people.
Yep.
You're a journalist. Use it that way. And so the same with Facebook. There are people I've met there, people I have connections there with, I don't have anywhere else. And for me to say, ugh, Facebook, means I'm also saying, ugh, those friends, those people.
Yeah, that's the challenge. Absolutely.
And I'm not willing to do that. And the other thing is, they've screwed up plenty. And I wrote a piece a few weeks ago about that. Though I argue that the complaints about them, surveillance capitalism, no, that's not the problem. The problem is a Silicon Valley problem of their culture, which I do criticize. But I still think it's important to remember that what the internet does and what these things do is connect you with human beings. So I was on this CNBC thing this afternoon and. With Farhad Manjoo and with others, and Jaron Lanier came in at the end, and when I made this point about privilege, he just screamed at me. So at least you guys aren't doing that.
Well, I would push back on that in the following way. When you invest in Facebook as the place where you're connected to all those people, you are not connecting to all the people who have opted out of Facebook or never opted in the first place. So when I moved to my thing called the Nice Book, and by the way, I'm mentioning this cryptically, but if you are interested in this project of mine of leaving Facebook and replacing it with a folder and Google Photos, go to elgin.com/Facebook, and I explain the whole thing, why I'm doing it, et cetera. But once I did that and I moved to Google Photos, all these people who have never been on Facebook started seeing my photos for the first time. A few older people who never saw any of my photos on Facebook all these years. I've been on Facebook 10 years or something like that.
For whatever reason, over the course of their years, they did not want to sign up for Facebook, they didn't care, or just didn't know, or whatever.
They think it's like they don't want to, you know, like older people, like my late father. Never saw Facebook. He didn't survive long enough to see my nice book. But like other people that I know in my family and so on that would normally see want to see all this stuff and know what's going on, that type of stuff I post on Facebook didn't see it. Plus all the quitters. So many quitters now. And this is one of the things I'm, you know, to a certain extent, I'm trying to convince people to get off Facebook to, but part of the goal is to weaken their network effect so that people don't say, well, it doesn't matter if they're the most unethical company in history. I have to be there because everybody's there. That's what people, that's the logic people use to as to why they're there. Well, what if everybody wasn't there? What if only 70% of the people who are currently on Facebook were on Facebook? Then suddenly they wouldn't have this grip on everybody, which gives them a license to do pretty much anything they want, that grip, right? It's like they're like the phone system. And that's
are you on WhatsApp? Are you on WhatsApp?
WhatsApp is another one. You know, WhatsApp.
And are you on it?
A lot of people. No. I'm getting off all four of them. I've never used WhatsApp. I did already get off Instagram. But like, there are lots and lots of people I know who are on only Instagram and Facebook, or they're like, I'm quitting Facebook and just going to use Instagram. It's like, well, you're still helping Mark Zuckerberg be unethical.
See, I mean, obviously, again, please replay my disclosure earlier. And again, they've screwed up things I'm criticized, but I'm sorry. I don't buy that they're the most evil company ever by a long shot. I think they've screwed up some things. I think they've screwed up some things. I think they still have, they still believe in a mission of connecting the world. I think they're too opaque, and that's what gets them in trouble. They need to rethink their culture so that anything they do withstands the light of sunshine. But I think it's possible that can happen. But I got to disagree, Mike. I think, you know, I'll take a lot of banks and a lot of oil companies and a lot of pharma companies and the company that addicted half of the people who died of overdoses for Purdue Pharma. Those are evil companies.
I would not. And if I did say it, I'll retract it. But I would not say they're the most unethical company I was in the world. I mean, they definitely are not. But it's a combination of their actual lack of ethics plus their incidental effect on people. For example, every time there's a story about teen depression being caused by social, they are talking specifically, primarily about Facebook and Instagram. They are deliberately and willfully addictive. They try to gobble up as much of people's days as possible, and they're very good at it.
We're here doing a 2-hour show. What are we trying to do?
We don't have 2 hours.
Media is the same. Media is exactly the same. We're in the same business.
And many companies would want.
We're not
that
succeeding.
As a goal,
that's the point. I mean, you see what I'm saying?
It's like, okay until you're too good at it.
Every startup would love to have people glued to their product six hours a day.
Absolutely.
But Facebook is the only company that actually achieves it. And so I think as a force in nature, we talk endlessly about their effect on journalism. They just basically the largest publisher in history. They're not a publisher, but the largest source of news in history. They throw a switch, and by the way, one of the things I've noticed is when I write my anti-Facebook screeds on Facebook, they get zero. The engagement, just because I know they've thrown a switch and they're not distributing it. Hmm. They just decide secretly behind the scenes where nobody can see.
I've seen your screeds. Maybe people just disagree. Because don't forget, Mike, don't forget, in all fairness, you know I love you.
Yeah.
But you're basically criticizing everyone who's there. You're saying you're all sheeple for being here and I'm not. Well, a lot of us disagree and I find real value there.
I think the way I look at it is nobody's a sheeple. I mean, people are people. And it's their human mindset that's being manipulated by Facebook and Instagram to get people to where they're addicted and compelled to do this performance every day, especially on Instagram. But I'm not saying that people are bad and I'm good. What I'm saying is that I'm a trained and licensed professional. I spend my whole life reading about this stuff, learning about this stuff. And you're an ordinary person who doesn't, you have a real job. You're not a journalist. You have better things to do than read the mountains of evidence that Facebook is this unethical company. So I'm here to to inform you of things you didn't know. Because when I do write about these things, people are like, really? And it's like, you know, people, our job is to inform people so they can make their own choices. Mm. And so I don't tell anybody, I think you should do this. I tell people, I've looked at all of this evidence and I've decided to do this. You may want to look at this evidence yourself and make your own decision. And people do. And I understand that it's like super easy to use Facebook to stay connected with people. Instagram, I mean, to a certain extent, the value of this for people is approaches a genuine need, right?
Mm-hmm. I think you're not giving people credit for the agency and choices they make, and you're insulting them. I'm not there because I'm an addict. I'm there because I find value in it.
Well, I'm not insulting people for not knowing, not having an encyclopedic knowledge of
you're saying that you know more about this than they do. Again, I love you, Mike. You know that. But you're saying, because and I quoted you often about what made Google Plus better, right? There were design decisions there was better until the end. But no, you're saying there's an absolute here that it's bad and addictive and awful, and you know better. And you're basically saying the other people shouldn't be there. And I'm saying that people have legitimate reasons to disagree with you and find value there that you need to respect.
I do respect them if they have a disagreement that's informed by knowledge of what Facebook does. Unfortunately, 99% of the people, I would guess, I'm making that number up, obviously, on Facebook have no idea. Like there are surveys that where a majority didn't even know that Facebook like adjusted the algorithms for what they're seeing in their news feeds. Like people don't know the most basic things. They certainly don't know about the creepy research they do. They certainly
they don't know how media companies target ads to you. How media That's companies true. Make how decisions. They do.
Our
they
job in journalism is to inform them about all of it. And so you know, I'm just basically choosing to be to try to be an influencer on this particular thing. So Walt Mossberg, about a week after I announced that I was going to do this whole project, he announced that he was getting off, and he made it clear in Twitter that saying, I'm not saying anybody else should get off Facebook, mm-hmm. But I've decided that based on what I know about their ethical lapses, I don't feel comfortable contributing to their blah-blah-blah, but I'm not saying anybody else should get on. And I'm saying that I do think people should get off. And I'm not saying it's because I'm better than other people. I'm just saying because I know a lot of stuff. Here's the stuff I know, and I'm trying to inform people. And it's not even just the old stuff. The new transgressions are coming so fast and furious. It's two or three a week.
Almost to the point, though, that it goes counter, right? Like it's so fast and furious that even if you wanted to kind of make sense of it and get enraged about it, you kind of don't have the time or the bandwith to do that. Overlook it.
They're like the Trump administration. There's so many scandals that any new scandal is like, yeah, whatever. Whereas,
but you also have to look at the media perspective here. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Mike. The media perspective is become so constantly negative. You have the case, which I wrote about in the New York Times piece. Oh my God, Netflix is reading your messages.
Yeah.
Well, yes, logically. People wanted Facebook to open up and not just be the closed garden. They enabled people to send messages from Netflix that required that Netflix had to have read, write, and delete access. And it was the only way the function could work. It was obvious. It was logical. And the New York Times was being dumber than a congressman. In that. So you see that kind of coverage out there now is constant. Yeah. And you see people like Farhad Manjoo saying, delete this stuff. And it's become a drumbeat of media, and media are not admitting their own corruptible motives here because they think that Facebook is competing for the attention and time that they think they deserve. And so the problem is that it's become my fear is that the reason I stand up for this, Mike, mm-hmm. reason is because what I fear the end result of this is not about Facebook. It's about the internet. Yeah. And I've just joined a transatlantic working group on content moderation and freedom of speech read regulation.
Yeah.
This can be a meeting because I see all kind and I'm debating next week whether to go to a thing in Brussels while I'm in Europe. About content moderation. Well, content moderation is another way to say killing people's voices. And I fear that we're going to see a whole raft of regulation of the net coming out of this fear of a company or two. And it's early days.
Well, I mean, I would content moderation when a company does it is killing people's voices. Content moderation when a user does it is the opposite of that, because
you have the perfect. I'm not saying that you should be on Facebook. Yeah. I'm just saying respect me for my decision to be there.
And
I do know, I do cover this. I do know a lot about this.
I'm super concerned, and, as you are, about the overall coverage, the sort of drumbeat of, and the mushing, the mental mushing of all these things into a single thing. The worst case is something actually on the rundown. What is the publication that did this about Sidewalk Labs' replica? So Sidewalk Labs is Google's or Alphabet's division or company for improving cities, for building smart cities. And they have a project called, they have a product called Replica. And what Replica is it's like a sim city for urban planners. They go to an urban planner, they go to Toronto, and they're like, oh, if you like rejigger the city like this, this is where everybody would go and what the traffic would be like and where the parking and all that kind of stuff. But the movement of these, you know, sim city like characters through this thing, are based on real data. They're using people's real data. They're getting it from maps, and who knows where they're getting it. And this this article is up in arms about it. But they're de-identifying it. In other words, they're removing the that data is not associated with any specific people. It's just
it's valuable data. This fear of data. So it's right now, we're, my view is we're in a mode where I think the fight is to be prevented from being part of data, but then we're going to want data back. So I'll give you a quick example on Facebook. So everybody, Cambridge Analytica, everybody went after Facebook, and Facebook found it created an API so you could go in and see political ads. That was being misused. Facebook shut it down. The researchers are screaming. And Alex Stamos, who really knows his stuff, who left Facebook, who's now at Stanford, said, be careful what you wish for, folks. Because when you exposed Cambridge Analytica and you said this is all awful and all terrible, the way that guy got the data was trying to give researchers some data so that they could find out insights about people, and that's what the researchers want. Well, it got misused by one guy in one company, so then Facebook comes back and they cut it off, and then the researchers scream bloody murder, you're keeping the information from us. They're often in a difficult position like that. So Google, too. I want to stand up for the idea that knowledge and the idea of knowledge that comes out of data should be protected. And we not only have a right from data, but at some point we have a right to data. We have a right to be able to learn things and understand things. And but when we make this, especially in Europe, privacy uber alles, which I understand and I get it, but it has other implications that we have to be able to examine. And they're not all negative, and they're not all out of some malign motive.
Yeah. And I agree with all that. Your argument often whenever there's a story about techno panic is, what is the actual harm? And so if there's tracking and so on, that's a great question that isn't nearly asked enough in general in these conversations, certainly not in the breathless coverage of tracking and all that kind of stuff. But in the case of Facebook, the harm is right in front of us. There are mob lynchings in India because of the way that WhatsApp functions. There are teen suicides because of the way WhatsApp functions. They damage democracies. They're a wonderful tool for propagandists and tyrants, wonderfully effective tool. They cause depression. They cause addiction. The list of actual material damage to people and societies is extremely evident, and that's the difference. This stuff about Google getting data so that cities can design better cities, there is literally no harm. They're trying to actually improve the lives of people. And in the case of a lot of the tracking stuff that goes on with Amazon and so on, the harm is really difficult to find. With Facebook, it's right there. The stories of actual harm, people being harmed, are everywhere.
There's also stories of real benefit. And I caution the presumption of, we see these stories everywhere. For example, the presumption that we're all in a filter bubble.
Yeah.
Erasmus Kleist-Nielsen at the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism at Oxford often points out the evidence doesn't show that. The data doesn't show that. There aren't studies that show we're a filter bubble. Actually, the truth is the exact opposite, that being on the internet exposes you to more opinions than you otherwise would have had. We've got to be evidence-based, and it's harm and evidence both.
Yeah.
So I want to see the evidence, and I want to see what's what, and I want to see the countervailing. So if we come up with a new rule to prevent that,
right,
what else are we then giving up? What opportunities are we giving up as a result?
Right. The statistical and the cognitive bias angle against my own argument is that Facebook is just massive at scale. If they're twice as big as another company, they should have twice as many horrible things that happen. And and if you're inclined toward anti-Facebook thinking, then you'll dismiss all the positive stuff that they do, and you'll focus on the bad stuff they do. And there's lots of bad stuff because they just have so many users. They're so gigantic. And I understand that argument. To me, the thing that you're talking about, the people's right to have information, I think people also need the right to have information that isn't informed by a single entity and the way that they do business. Their algorithms, the problem with algorithms, of course, that Google grapples with this in Europe all the time, is that they are secret. Nobody can see them. There's no sunlight being shown on those. So how do they work? Why do they work the way they work? This is problematic. But I think that the most solid argument that you can make about Facebook, that's the most evidence based argument, is the fact that they do have so many users. How many people on? What is the total number of actual bodies who are using Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, and Facebook Messenger? It's probably fewer than they say, but
each service billions. Is more than billion. Yeah.
Yeah. It's probably a couple billion.
And then when you talk about Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp all combining their services together.
Right. So,
then you're talking even more of the monopolistic sort of discussion around Facebook.
I have to admit that I love the idea of there being of sources of information, especially when everything's algorithmically filtered for different reasons, to be distributed and the sources for those to be multifaceted instead of mostly from one place. Mm. Just the sheer
we're
reach
in far
of
better
Facebook
shape.
Scares the daylights out of me.
We're right there. We are in far better shape than we were 30, 40 years ago. When
of course.
You lived in Cleveland, you had one newspaper
right.
and three TV stations, and that was it. And it was controlled by a few white men. Who were gatekeepers to everything that you wanted to know and learn. And now through Facebook, through Twitter, through the internet itself, obviously, overall, we have the ability to get to all kinds of sources we never got to.
Those
before.
Benefits you're and talking about are benefits from the internet, not from Facebook
itself. They can also
itself.
Be benefits from Facebook.
Facebook
I have
participates in that process. But
I have discovered all kinds of wonderful and amazing things in people. Probably including the sponsor that Jason wants to get to now.
Especially the sponsor.
although I just have to throw in there real quick.
Sure, brought to you by Facebook.
Right.
Mike, you may leave the
building. Boy, it just got awkward. Since stepping away from Facebook and then in recently deleting it or whatever, the challenge is also the benefit in the sense that the big challenge is not knowing what everybody that I care about is really up to on a day-to-day basis. The benefit is that now I talk to them about it.
And also not knowing about the people you don't care about. That's another benefit.
That's true. That's another hidden benefit.
The kid from third grade I was following.
It was a long time. When I signed up for Facebook back in the early, the mid-2000s, it was, I got to collect as many friends as possible.
Yes.
Over time, it was like, why did I do that? I have no idea.
Felicity.
Let's take a break and thank the sponsor, and then we can get back. If we want to talk about Facebook more, we can. Zuckerberg had his op-ed. Maybe we can talk about that, or maybe we can talk about some other things. We'll figure it out. But first, this episode of This Week in Google is brought to you by OnDeck. OnDeck is 100% committed to small business owners with fast, easy, and tailored financing. Your time, of course, is valuable, so you can get funding in as fast as 24 hours with term loans up to $500,000 and lines of credit up to $100,000, none of which, by the way, requires business collateral. The application process is super simple. You can apply online or by phone and get approved in minutes, and it won't impact your personal credit. OnDeck delivers some of the best customer service with their U.S.-based loan specialists and has an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau. They've lent over $10 billion to over 80,000 small business owners and carry a 9.8 out of 10 rating on Trustpilot. OnDeck is the secure financing service that business owners everywhere can truly rely on. So you should check it out. If you're a small business owner and you need access to capital, go to ondeck.com/twig right now to check it out, read up on it, see what it's like. And as a listener of This Week in Google, you'll receive a free consultation with one of their US-based loan specialists. You can apply online or by phone. You're going to get approved in minutes. And all you have to do is go to ondeck.com/twig. That's ondeck.com/twig for your free consultation now. And we thank OnDeck for their support of This Week in Google. Do we want more Facebook or do we want to branch out?
There's a lot of stuff on this list.
Yeah. There really is.
I think Mike and I have done it.
Yes.
All right. So we've covered the Facebook.
Yeah, we can continue this conversation on Facebook.
Oh, we will. Oh, we will. I don't doubt. Let me be very clear. I really appreciate Mike. This is why you're so good at social. That we disagree. We have a wonderful back and forth, and I think that's. I really appreciate the tone of it. Thank you.
And don't forget, I'm saving technopanic.com for you. I still got it. I'm going to hang on to it until you decide to write that book.
Oh, you have it? I have it.
For you.
Yay, wow. Mike.
Yeah, because I was afraid.
We're going to do one more Facebook.
Okay, what is it?
This one. It is the fact that we have the sales department of Facebook complaining that engineers have been going from the restroom into the cafeteria in bare feet.
What?
So, see? Mike, you're right. Everything you say about Facebook.
Another thing to add to the list.
But this is right. Like the engineers are going, what would Zuck do? He'd also wear a bathrobe.
I'm happy you included that. We could at least end the Facebook thing.
And by the way, one other quick thing. It is interesting that they hired a new head of privacy from EFF. They're hiring really tough privacy people. So, you know, all this is making a difference. They're with one step forward, three back, trying to do some things. But we'll leave it there.
Soon they'll catch up on those steps a little bit. What about Huawei? Maybe a little bit. I mean, there was some news with Huawei, right? The U.S. Had their moment, I think, a couple of days ago where they put down two indictments of the U.S. From the U.S. Department of Justice to Huawei. This was unsealed on Monday, charging CFO Meng Wanzhou of fraud, money laundering, obstruction of justice.
Don't forget conspiracy.
And conspiracy. That's a fun one regarding the sanctions violations with Iran.
Is this real or is this politics? Do you guys have a perspective on this whole story?
I do. Yeah, I do.
Good.
I don't know if you.
I'm very much in the I don't really truly know what's going on, what to believe here.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yes, exactly.
Because there's a lot. It is highly political as well.
Right.
I'm also kind of confused because we review Huawei products on the network. And so then when a new Huawei product comes out, I'm like, well, do I review it? Like at what point do I say, let's not do that anymore?
Right.
Or I don't even know, you know, because it's hard to know what the truth is.
So
what do you think?
So there's the truth and then there's my theory, which is based loosely on how I understand the truth. So first of all, everyone needs to know, like Huawei is not a huge brand name. It's mostly known in the United States as a smartphone maker. Right. But they are the world's largest telecom company. So they are a giant. They're bigger than AT&T. They're just a huge company. They make equipment and so on. And my theory is that lots of governments believe very strongly that their identity as a private company is a bit of a mirage, and that in fact they're an arm of the Chinese government,
right?
And a tool of Chinese
time
government
and time again,
for them to achieve the objectives of the Chinese government. One of their objectives that everybody's freaked out about is that the Chinese government wants to have access to the future of 5G. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows 5G is coming. It's going to be super expensive and time consuming to switch everything over to 5G, right? And once they're there, they're going to want to, the Chinese government would love to have access to all of those points of whatever. And the Chinese government says that's ridiculous. They're a private company and Huawei says the same thing. But this is the suspicion it's not a Republican thing or a Democrat thing. This is since Bill Clinton, this has been the strong belief of the intelligence agencies in the United States, Britain, Germany, Australia, a whole bunch of countries. And so they can't prove it. They don't have really strong evidence for it, but they believe that this is essentially the Chinese government that's taken over, wants to take over 5G, that wants to have smartphones all over the place. And so they just oppose it. And so there's the claim that they may use Huawei equipment as a spy tool sounds like conspiracy theory or hysteria, and it might be, but that's what is believed. And in addition to that, the company did, in fact, separately from that, having nothing to do with whether or not they're the government, having nothing to do with whether or not they're spying, apparently wanted to sell equipment to Iran. Their U.S. has sanctions in place where it punishes companies mm-hmm. that do business with Iran. So they created a Hong Kong-based company called Skycom. And it was just Huawei, but it was just they pretended like it was a separate company. Skycom sold equipment to Iran. And when they interact with the banks, because the banks have to enforce this sanctions, they said, no, we were not associated with Skycom in any way, when in fact it was just Huawei. There was a wholly owned subsidiary of Huawei. That's what this is all about. That's what the fraud conspiracy and then their related charges of obstruction and then the money laundering is a separate thing. So in addition to this fear of the future of espionage, there appear to be, the claim is that there are actual violations of law around violating Iran sanctions. That's what this is all about. So
and then there's also an IP theft or intellectual property theft from T-Mobile.
That's the best part. So T-Mobile had this robot that was advanced. This is years ago, actually, that this happened. A robot called Tappy. And it was a way to simulate a bunch of users on phones, which various Chinese companies are super interested in for a whole bunch of reasons. And so a bunch of Huawei engineers were given access by T-Mobile to look at Tappy. They all signed agreements, whatever. But the accusation is that not only did they take a lot of pictures, did a bunch of measurements, just trying to extract as much information as possible, but they actually broke Tappy's arm off and stole it. So this is the accusation. This is the IP theft. So poor Tappy, the one-armed robot.
They actually broke an actual arm off
physically
of a robot.
Arm off of a robot named Tappy.
I didn't know if that was just like code for they figured out how to make it work.
No, they literally ripped his arm off of his shoulder socket and stuffed it in their pocket. And so that's the accusation. So there it is. And so one of the things that I think is really interesting is that the CEO, who is the founder of Huawei's daughter, mm-hmm. by the way, this is a nice little piece of trivia, Meng Wanzhou. She was arrested by Canadian authorities because the U.S. wanted her extradited to the U.S. to face these charges. And the speed and ferocity of the Chinese government's response kind of makes me think, that's weird. Because the Chinese government is behaving as if this was done to a diplomat or something.
Well, because, I mean, from what I understand, Huawei in China is one of the premier brands.
Yeah.
So and is very critical to the economy there, right? Like, I mean, there's so much money.
That's one theory. The other theory is that they're actually a wing of the People's Republic, People's whatever army.
Yeah.
Right. That's the accusation, that they're actually a part of the military. The military of China, and so they're considered like a potential military espionage scheme.
I wonder though is, so I think that's a very very good reporting on all of that, and thank you. Proof will be in the pudding if this just becomes a pawn in the larger trade negotiation.
Yes.
No, never mind.
Right.
Then that's when I'll decide how real the concern really was.
Yeah, and that is my fear as well. The timing is super suspicious. This is like really perfect timing to use it as a pawn in these negotiations, and that's exactly how President Trump negotiates. He does something horrible, and then they negotiate about the removal of that horrible thing.
Right.
He comes out ahead. This is the theory behind that style of negotiation. However, the specifics in the indictment look pretty solid, and I can't speak to the timing, but this seems like they very well may have done these things. And so there it is, and that also raises the larger question about America's control of the global financial system. When the U.S. puts trade sanctions on a country, there's a lot of pushback on that idea, that power, by China and Russia and others. Iran, because that's kind of devastating, and so that's a whole nother question. But yeah, I certainly hope this isn't just a bargaining chip. That would be awful.
You think Meng faces big time prison sentence potentially here in the U.S. I mean,
I guess so.
Potentially. I mean, it kind of seems like this is the kind of thing that they'd probably negotiate around that. And
yeah.
That, would be the end game, right?
Right.
But you also have Canadians who are in jail in China, probably in retribution for the Canada's arrest. And it's just, it's a lot of people's lives are wrapped up in this.
And yeah, and you know, she'll probably end up sharing a jail cell with El Chapo. That'll be an interesting situation.
The odd couple.
But
I didn't know El Chapo. So he's on trial in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
He's staying in the basement of the building because every time they were trying to transport him across, they had to close the Brooklyn Bridge.
Yes. Hilarious. I mean, the guy's a master. So if you're not familiar with this character, he's a master tunnel. He's escaped from multiple Mexican prisons.
Right.
The most spectacular case was they had a camera on him 24/7. And one day he just got up from his bunk and just disappeared behind the toilet. And they all panicked, went scrambling to his cell, opened it up, ripped off the toilet, and there was a tunnel. And in there was a track. And what they had built is a custom motorcycle that had like train track bottom. And he got on this track and just hit the gas on this motorcycle and went a mile in a mile long tunnel and then came out of a private house in town and disappeared into the ether. This guy is not to be trifled with in terms of jailbreaks. He's really good at it.
Wow. How do you even do that?
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess we'll have to interview El Chapo one of these days. Figure that out. how do you break out of jail? And then how do we think this is going to affect Huawei in its sales? And actually, I think maybe the more interesting direction that I actually want to go, like I'm thinking about going in this like smartphone sales direction. But then what I really want to talk about is like innovation, like this new brand of like we're used to seeing like Chinese phones be a few steps ahead in terms of innovation. And right now at this particular moment, we're seeing some really kooky things.
Yeah.
I'm curious to hear your guys' take on it.
I hope we're going
to
talk about the folding.
Let's start there. Xiaomi has posted to Weibo, I believe last week, a video of, I think one of their senior level co-founder and president Bin Lin has a tablet device. It's kind of like in a portrait setup tablet device. It's got a little bit of an arc to it, and I don't know if the video, if I included the video for you, John, and I'm sorry if I didn't, but anyways, he's using it, suddenly flips it over, folds the sides in, and it becomes a phone kind of in
with
portrait
screen on every
with screen on everything. It's like your quintessential modern foldable phone concept. You can kind of see a little bit of it down there.
So I did an analysis I think 3 months ago or something about this whole folding phone phenomenon, because Samsung has dangled some folding screen phones.
We're going to get something probably in weeks from Samsung.
Microsoft has a bunch of patents. There's a lot going on, and it seems like, oh, that's the next big thing. No, it is not. So these folding phones are not about to change the smartphone.
Oh, universe. Come on, Mike.
First of all, so you guys reported on All About Android, the amount of RAM in this thing. What was it like?
I think
like 16 gigs or something.
12,
like that.
Possibly. Yeah, it could have been 16.
It's pretty substantial. Because they're very resource intensive, which means they're going to be very battery intensive. And all of it, the combined with the technology and all the stuff that goes with it, means that they're going to be very, very expensive. So a phone like that he demonstrated, if they could go to market within the next year or so, that thing was going to be thousands of dollars.
Right. Well, and that's in line with what we're seeing
Leo,
around
Leo will
pricing
buy it.
For the guarantee. Nobody else. Like $1,500.
And then
Leo, I hope he does.
And it'll be good material for his comedy over the next year while he talk about how he like lost all this money on this piece of junk. And the other thing is that when you think about wear and tear on any sort of physical device, it just reason suggests that opening, closing, folding, unfolding, this thing is gonna, and you can even see it, even with all the prototypes, they try to do special lighting and stuff on stage to try to dazzle everybody with this new technology. You can see that that when it's fully folded out, it's never flat. It's always kind of
it
has a memory about where it was creased and all that kind of stuff. It's just
I believe in All About Android, we call that the pucker.
Yeah, to quote Steve Jobs about the stylus, yuck, right? Nobody
What's
wants
interesting
that.
To me is between that and the other phone that has no buttons of any sort, it's just this idea of class. So you hear the platform, you hear people at Facebook and elsewhere talk about things. They talk about the Surface. There's a Surface for this and a Surface for that.
Yeah.
That's the way they kind of think of it, right?
And now you rethink that surface and how anything can be done on it, and they can, and these things can be anywhere, and you can interact with them. It just starts to open up your mind about not just this single device that you carry around that operates in certain ways. It starts to at least make us think about other ways that we could interact with them.
That's true.
Yep. Well, and I do think we're on the revolution we are on the brink of is the revolution of screens everywhere, intelligence in everything, where, and we talked about this, I think, on Twit a couple months ago, where it will be such a radical shift that the concept of sitting down to use a computer will seem quaint to kids who are like now 10 years old when they hear us geezers talking about how like, oh, we're going to sit down and use a computer. They're like, what are you talking about? Because like, you'll never not be using a computer. They'll be everywhere. They'll be listening for your command at all times, and you'll have augmented reality in your glasses, and virtual reality will always be nearby, and the window in your office will be a screen, and like it'll just go on and on. It'll be, in my view, a kind of paradise. I'm sure there'll be downsides to it, but it sounds great to me. The future is not folding smartphones.
Folding smartphones is how you get there, though.
Right. Well, folding smartphones is, to me, an example of desperately throwing advanced technology at a platform in order to milk it some more, but it's over. The smartphone margins, even Apple's, struggling to make those margins.
Yes, absolutely.
They're commodity devices. The innovation is in the AI, in the phone, and the services that you use. And in terms of user interfaces, it's going to be screens everywhere, screens in your glasses, augmented reality, and lots of other things. Voice interfaces are going to change everything, but it's not going to be folding smartphones. Mm-hmm. It's both too early and too late for folding smartphones.
Will it be buttonless, portless phones?
Sure. But the interface, the interface that will enable it will be voice, because if you can talk to it and it does things for you, then, you know, you don't need to be poking at it. It's not going to be flexible screens. Flexible screens have a place as long as you don't flex them. So, for example, all these phones that have the screen that kind of go around the edge, those are flexible screen phones.
Can't do anything with them.
As long as you don't move it,
right?
You know, and bend it, then it's great.
Not the vision that we have of like unrolling a scroll and having that be a display that you can like roll up into a nice roll. And
I think there'll be uses away. For that, but it's not going to be the smartphone replacement. I think there'll be, you know, I think there'll be things, you know, smart placemats for, you know, dinner table. I don't know what it is. There'll be like objects. There'll be IoT objects that happen to have screens that fold, but it's not going to be, you know, we've really been empowered by having supercomputers in our pockets. They do everything for us. They've replaced flashlight, everything from flashlights to radios to this to that, whatever. And that is a powerful thing and will continue to be a powerful thing until we get all these next generation things years and years in the future. But there's not going to be a period where everyone's got folding, or even a significant minority has folding screen phones. They're too expensive. They're too unreliable. They're too ugly. There's too many problems with these things. And these companies that are trying to dazzle everybody with this next generation technology, yes, the technology is impressive as technology.
Right.
And yes, companies have been working on it for decades, and they're finally getting to the point where it kind of functions. But all this dazzling demo stuff is not going to result in a revolution in the consumer marketplace.
The phone is so last era of technology.
Exactly.
What is the next era?
I mean, you guys did a great job on All About Android about heckling this whole thing, about how, you know, he tried, even in the demo, it's just like
he had to kind of clunk it together. And even when you watch it, like once it snaps into place, you see the UI do 10 corrections before it finally figures it out and frames properly.
Right, and you're always touching the touchscreen, and some things are launching.
How do you reject your fingers and everything? So, one thing that struck me while you were talking about like this tech utopia, this future where technology, where screens are everywhere, and that's going to be a wonderful place, makes me wonder if we aren't as users of technology conflicted with what we actually want. Mm-hmm. On one hand, that sounds like a tech enthusiast's desire to have something, you know, all this technology everywhere, and it knows what you want before you know it, and it can predict all this stuff. At the same time, that's exactly, you know, a lot of the same stuff that we criticize technology companies for doing.
Mm-hmm. Right,
how do we find that balance? Like, how is there a connective tissue between one point where it's bad. We don't want that, but yet we want the outcome of it.
If we can't have it, okay, here's the rule. If we can't have it, it's good. Once we get it, it's bad.
Great, that I fear the future.
I think it's almost impossible to predict technology. When you look back at the predictions from the late 20th century about what the future, what happened in the future, nobody said, oh, we're going to have these, we're going to have these social networks that track people and do all this kind of, we're going to have flying cars and jetpacks and it was going to be amazing. The truth is, as Jeff alluded earlier, in fact, it has been transformative. It has changed our lives. The phones, smartphones especially, but lots of technology has really, really changed our lives despite all the problems we're experiencing societally. So it's impossible to say what those future problems will be. I'm sure that we will have them.
Yeah,
there will be abuses. There'll be lots and lots of problems. I think that the greatest laboratory for what's possible in terms of abuse by technology is happening in China. They're becoming an Orwellian high tech police state where they're tracking everybody. The social credit thing. The most recent news is that I don't know if it's a news or rumor. Somebody can in the chat room can let me know if this is actually verified news or just a rumor that I'm mongering here, but that there's an app or something where if you get within a certain number of yards of somebody who owes money, that it alerts you so you can turn them in and all. They're going in directions that are extremely dark.
Well, I mean, it just always kind of reminds me of Black Mirror, the social currency episode of Black Mirror. Yep. And watching that and being like, man, that's a strange world, and then realizing that it's already happening in China. And if that is a foundation, that's actively operating there, I mean, who is to say that that doesn't end up everywhere else? Right. It doesn't end up here, maybe not in exactly that same way, but you better believe there are lessons being learned about how it's implemented there that will be integrated into how it operates here. And that might be looking into our future.
I mean, I think we're going to see a difference between free societies and unfree societies, not based on who has technology and who doesn't, but who has the power to use that technology, the right. It's going to be a legal issue. It's going to be a situation. So let me give you an example. I wrote a column years and years ago called "I Want to Live in a Surveillance Society." Everybody's like complaining about surveillance cameras everywhere in London, like all this surveillance was happening. And my view was, okay, we're going to have surveillance technology, but the public gets it too. Like we get to surveil them. We get to watch the watchers. It's not just every time there's and this is one of the things that, you notice if you're a technology historian over time, is that every time there's new technology, the authorities, whoever they are, governments, police organizations, authoritarian governments, free governments, everybody says, oh, great, there's new technology. We can monopolize this to increase our power over our opponents, which in the case of law enforcement is over the criminals. So, for example, and these things have to be dealt with in the court. So if all of a sudden you get new surveillance technology, right, the police want to use it and ban everybody else from using it. Mm-hmm. Or the classic example is in interrogation. Interrogation rooms have existed forever. But as soon as there was inexpensive digital video, now there's a camera in every interrogation room. That footage is used in courtrooms, but only the police can decide whether it's on or not on, or they have a one-sided control over digital video surveillance technology in a situation where they are mano a mano with a suspect, right? So, and there have been cases where people have secretly recorded interrogations in court. It was established that based on those recordings that the police had lied. I'm not anti-police here. There's some bad apples in every profession. Even journalism. And so in those cases, that's a perfect example of how, okay, if somebody's going to record an interrogation, let's all record it. Right? And this is going to be the difference. So the surveillance technology in China is only creepy because they are claiming a monopoly on that ability. If I also have an app that tells me when a creditor is coming to get me, if I owe money, that's a free society.
Yeah.
If only the people who are out to get the people who owe money have that technology, that's an unfree society. Anyway.
Right. Great. That's the future. We're staring at the future.
Yeah, super depressing.
Thanks for cheering us up. Why don't we cheer everyone up with a little Google change log?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
The Google changelog.
Maybe there's some things in here that'll cheer you up. Let's see here. We kind of already did the Gmail update for Android. It's getting brighter, so look for that update. I got it today, and it does look better. It's just not inbox. Anyways, we've already talked about that. If you've ever visited a site and you look up in the URL bar and it looks like the right URL, and then you realize, oh, wait a minute, they put in a character there that, you know, basically a fraudulent URL to make you think you're going to one place when you're actually going someplace else. Apparently, Google Chrome Canary 70 has introduced a feature called Navigation Suggestions for Lookalike URLs. Once that flag is active, a panel will actually appear underneath the URL bar when it detects that a URL is close but incorrect. And it'll say something like, did you mean to go to paypal.com instead of PayPal or whatever the case may be? No word on when it's going to officially ship in the main release.
How is that a first step to killing the URL?
I have no idea. You know what? Oh, that might be
the wrong. That was the Wired headline.
that might be the wrong. Well, I think, I think that's the wrong link. But that has something to do with.
No, it's the right link. It's just.
I may have pulled this information from a related story, and it's not talking about that particular thing. Google has something going on right now where they're changing the Omnibox to show sites differently. Maybe this is part of it. I'm not really quite sure, but anyways,
whatever it is, I'm against it.
All right, good. Thanks for the backup. Speaking of the Omnibox, let's see here. Chrome is apparently kind of sprucing it up to make it a little bit more search friendly. Do more activities from there directly. So if you want to copy a web page, you can see in that little screenshot the page that you're on. It has a little copy or share button right next to it. So instead of having to go up there and copy the URL or whatever, it's like a single tap. You can do that and move on with your
That's
life.
Nice. How many URLs do you think you copy per day? In my case, it's probably 50.
Oh.
I mean, just constantly doing
it. Yeah, I don't know if it's that much, but definitely when I'm doing a show, I'm copying URLs left, right, and center for sure.
That's
absolutely.
And tweeting.
So that'll be nice. Also adding voice input capabilities into the mobile search bar. So kind of embedded in there. I don't know if this appears on iOS. I know in the mobile web search, it's appearing on Android. I don't see why it wouldn't appear on iOS. But basically, it's kind of one step more towards bringing Assistant into everything that they're doing, bringing that voice search into the actual bar instead of just in the OS that you're using or whatever the case may be. So, and also, I think it will read your results out to you in its fun robotic voice. If you like.
I'm in favor. That's awesome.
I think this is pretty neat. Of course, I have children, but they might be a little old for this. Maybe my 5-year-old would like this. Apparently, Google Home now now works with a number of Disney, those golden books that have the golden covers. If you are reading a supported book, and you tell Google Home to go into a particular mode, like story time or something like that, it will listen to you as you read it. And as you say certain words, it will time like sound effects and music that coordinate with that story. So if it's Coco, for example, and you introduce, you know, this page where Coco comes in and plays a guitar, suddenly Google Home is playing, you know, that guitar song or whatever. Kind of a neat little interactive thing that Google Home is apparently doing with some supported books. I think there's like 20 books that are supported right now. So who knows how many of those they're going to open up. But
as a parent, what do you think about that?
I think it's neat. I think you really have to go a long way to like do that though, right? Like I'd have to know that my Google Home supports this particular book, or I'd have to buy that book with the thought that, okay, I'm going to go home with it now. Maybe they'll have something called out on the books that says works with your Google Home.
Yeah.
That might be a good way to raise awareness. I would probably forget.
Yeah.
Probably forget to use it.
But it's probably first step in basically doing that for all books, for everybody maybe, or, you know, in an extreme case.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I also think it might be a distraction. It's like adding special effects to story time. For especially really young children, my own impulse would be to, like, let's just teach the kids to immerse themselves in a book.
Yeah,
you know,
in a story. Without the they can fill in the gaps.
Showbiz in the background. For older kids, it might be fun. I mean, who knows? But I think we're going to get to the point where someday every book will be an audiobook automatically, where the reading of it, special effects, all that stuff will be just compiled on the fly. probably 5-10 years away from something like that. But this is a first step.
Yeah, it's neat. Like, it's actually pretty familiar to me because we, I can't remember the name of it, but my daughter has, it's a stuffed animal and, you know, it has a computer inside of it and a speaker and everything like that. And there's a series of books that works with that animal.
Yeah.
That when you turn the animal on and you read the story, it's always listening for these particular hot words in the story.
Yep.
And when you get to that point in the story, that triggers the doll to like laugh or say, oh, that was so funny or whatever, or interact with the story. So it reminds me a lot of that. And I know when my daughters were younger, they loved that. They thought that was awesome. Right. Like, I'm telling the story and then all of a sudden the doll is talking to them and it's totally related. So I could see it being a cool thing. And then finally, I did not put this in here. I think that...
It's my fault. I put it in the wrong place.
Oh, okay.
I didn't mean to put it there. It has nothing to do with the changelog.
Well, you should know that discarded smart light bulbs reveal your Wi-Fi passwords. They're stored in the clear.
I meant to put that in other and I put it in the wrong place. Sorry about that.
That's okay. We got it in there anyways. That is the Google changelog. All right, we are going to take a break and thank the sponsor of this episode and then come back and do tips, tricks, numbers, whatever we happen to have. I think we've got a bunch of options down there, so we'll get into that in a second. But first, this episode of This Week in Google is brought to you by Capterra. You know, it's 2019. If you're still doing the things at work the same way that you did it last year, maybe it's time to start the year off right and replace things like software that's causing you agony or anxiety or whatever. You know the software that you don't need anymore. You know the one. You can find software that you love that fits your business needs better than that software at capterra.com/twig. Capterra is the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. With over 700,000 reviews of products from real software users, you can discover everything that you need to make an informed decision. You can search more than 700 specific categories of software. You're going to find everything in there. Project management to email marketing to yoga studio management software. For those of you in the back, that's right, I'm talking to you. No matter what kind of software your business needs, Capterra makes it easy to discover the right solution for you and fast. Join the millions of people who use Capterra each month to find the right tools for their business. You can visit capterra.com/twig, and you can do that for free, and you'll find the right tools to make 2019 the year for your business. That's capterra.com/twig. I'll spell that out. CAPTERRA.com/twig. And we thank Capterra for their support of This Week in Google. All right. Mike. Let me start with you. What is your tool or number or thing or whatever you want to call it?
It is a tool. So recently, Microsoft got a lot of press because they added, you know, the basic story that people were getting was that the Edge browser was getting sort of this anti-fake news feature. And what that was actually was that it now supports NewsGuard. And because nobody uses Microsoft Edge, everyone should know that NewsGuard is actually a plugin that you can use in Chrome, especially, but also even Firefox and Safari. And I recommend it. So if you want to get this, it's newsguardtech.com. And what it does is really actually very cool. This by the way, is a startup that was run by, it has two CEOs, Stephen Brill, the famous Stephen Brill, and former Wall Street Journal publisher Gordon Krovitz. They are co-CEOs of NewsGuard. And when you have the extension installed, it puts a badge on every recognized news source, whether you see it in search results, on Twitter, Facebook, Reddit, wherever it is, it puts a little badge. If it's a
into green, the page?
In, right next to the link
or
the headline or whatever it is. And that is that's the rating for the news source, not the article specifically. So if it's green, that means they say this is a reputable organization. They do fact checking. They do blah, blah, blah. They have a long list of criteria. If it's red, that means it's Breitbart or some other, you know, purveyor of falseness in one way or another. If it's gray, that means it's some, you know, all the British publications, the Daily Mail, et cetera, they're all gray because there's like, well, they do some good journalism, but they also do some not so good journalism. And so, when you click on the badge, you get what they call a nutrition label. So they actually go through all the criteria and say, okay, they do this, they do this, they don't do that, but they do this, 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 this.
Nice.
And it's it's just like turn by turn directions in Google Maps. Don't take it too literally. Think for yourself. Don't drive off a cliff because it says, you know, keep going. But it's just a nice visual thing where, you know, if you're about to click on something, you see a red badge, you're like, you know what? I'm not even going to click on it. Mm-hmm. And that's a, you know, it's a time saver, I think, and also a consciousness raiser above all. All you have to do is go to the if you're using Google Chrome, go to the Chrome store, search for NewsGuard and install it. And it just happens magically.
Nice. I'm definitely going
to. The only caution I'll have about that is that I and I'm involved in a project trying to aggregate many, many, many signals of quality and news. It's a one size fits all judgment.
Yes.
And I'm not sure that necessarily can hold. There isn't a universal definition of trust. And so, you know, they put the Daily Mail on the red list and other people think it's wonderful. And we can debate about that. But it's hard to imagine one entity deciding for everybody.
Yeah, the way I think people should think about NewsGuard is that it's like subscribing to a publication. When you have a publication, if you subscribe to your local newspaper, okay, the newspaper is the editorial department is run by editors who are making decisions about what to cover, how to cover it, enforcing things. They're also essentially buying, for lack of a better term, articles from Reuters and news aggregators that they trust. But you're trusting that editor if you subscribe to that magazine. So you think of NewsGuard as an editor company. They're making editorial judgments. And just as there are different types of newspapers that have different criteria for their editorial judgments, this is just one editorial judgment company.
Right, but it's one that cuts across every news source.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's a little bit different in that sense.
Exactly.
As opposed to being able to say, I want to look at what the editor of the Telegraph says, what the editor of the Guardian says, and I'll get a triangulation of different viewpoints.
That's why I say think for yourself, but see how you like it, and you may choose that to not use them and maybe use another one or not use any or whatever, but it is a time saver. I think in general, their criteria are very good. The biggest criticism I have for them is there are so many publications they have not evaluated. So they're just blank. They don't have a badge of any kind.
All right.
And so you're kind of you're exactly where you were.
Yeah, before, exactly. That's what I was just going to say.
But it does surface the degree to which Google kind of like, you know, the results are kind of like, huh, you know, because sometimes you go, you know, if you go to Google News, you search for something and it'll show you five things or something like that. And oftentimes the top one has a red badge.
Oh, interesting. You're
like, why is there this big disagreement? Like they'll put a Breitbart story as the number one source for some political news. Hmm. And so it kind of, who's wrong there? Is it NewsGuard or is it Google? In my estimation so far, it's been Google. I would prefer that Google not elevate those to the top. Most of the time, their top stories are all green. Hmm. But anyway, it's something
very
to play with.
Interesting. That's NewsGuard, newsguardtech.com. Right on. I'm going to check that out. Jeff, you've got a few different number
options. Yeah, so here's one. So I went to a town hall with my newly elected Congressman, Tom Malinowski, here in Jersey, and he was talking. People were asking, how do we get in touch with you? They said, oh, social media. And but then he explained that he had to have two accounts on each platform. It was a requirement now. So the one is Rep. Tom Malinowski and one is Tom Malinowski. And the latter is his account and he can say whatever he wants on it. But the other is the government account. And he cannot obviously use that in any way to promote the private account because the private account is basically considered permanently to be campaign. And the public account, the Rep. Tom Malinowski account, or the Rep. Ocasio-Cortez account, Rep. AOC account, is considered using official resources.
Wow.
So which I think is kind of vaguely interesting and probably not actually a terrible thing. But what it amounts to is nobody's going to follow the Rep. Accounts because all you're going to get is press releases there. Whereas if you call, I mean, I wrote a piece a few weeks ago about Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, comparing her use of Twitter to Trump in McLuhan-esque terms. But I think she is just incredibly brilliant at how she uses social media to do all kinds of great things, to explain, to have stands, to argue, to counteract in absolutely brilliant ways. And not just Twitter, but all the social platforms. But anyway, there's an AOC account, and that's her. And there's Rep AOC account, and that's officialdom.
And that system is what we've had for the president since the beginning. So there's the POTUS account, which
right.
is passed from president to president, and there's real Donald Trump.
Right.
I just would like to point out, though, that these politicians who are really good at Twitter, like President Trump, like Cortez, they are good at using social media not to so much thrill the public, but to attract the media. So they use it as a lever to get media coverage, and that's something to keep in mind if you ever run for president, because
it's our day to disagree a little bit, Mike.
Okay.
I think that's true of Trump. I think people give Trump credit for being good at Twitter. He's not. Media write a news story every single time he tweets, and so he just is using media, and that's that.
That's right.
Whereas AOC, I think, is very different. She was ignored by media. She couldn't get arrested near any publications in New York. The only way that she got elected was through social media, and she developed her own relationship with people there. And so she often is very dismissive of what the media does, doesn't care. The media is now following after her because they realize the boat they missed. But her social media presence is sufficient unto itself.
So
I think there are lessons there for everybody to use social media well. She has constructive, smart conversations there.
Yes, and she's also good on regular media. She's a good interview. We have to talk about her because she's probably the most visible and effective freshman ever. I mean, and it's because of her use of media, both social and other. But I would say that to get elected, yes. But now that she's elected, I mean, I read stories about her all the time in my political news feed. She's like, you know, she's like one of the top people out of nowhere, and she said this, and she said that, and she said, you know, mm-hmm. she's saying all these things, and then when you dig down, you realize she's saying it on Twitter. That's, you know, so I think now that she's in office, I think a lot of her media is just people are going to her for the interview, but a lot of her media is like she tweeted something, and some of her best stuff is on Twitter. Like some of her most quotable mm-hmm. stuff is mm-hmm. they're quoting tweets.
Yeah. Interesting.
And you, sir?
And for me, I got two. One of them is an actual tool, and it's care of Kevin Toefel, friend of the show. He wrote on his aboutchromebooks.com site that Chrome OS 73 dev channel apparently supports instant tethering for some non-Pixel devices for the very first time. This is a feature that you could do if you have a Pixel device and you have a Chrome OS device. You can have it instantly tether, automatically hop onto your phone's data connection when it senses that it's close and you've got it all set up. Apparently, he got it working with a Nokia 7 Plus and a Pixel Slate. And others are reporting that it works with the S9 and the OnePlus 6T. So the feature hasn't officially been announced yet, so probably there will be more information about this as it's developed out further. A device list maybe be released at some point, but you need to enable the flag in order for it to start working, and then when you visit the settings, you can connect and verify the device, and hopefully it'll work for you. So
carriers
must check
hate
out.
That. Carriers must hate that. They want you to get another right. SIM card and another account.
Of course
account.
They do.
And this, you know, they're offering all these unlimited accounts. And if you can just piggyback on that,
yep.
you only need one SIM card.
Yeah,
one account.
Absolutely. And then another piece, which is just because it makes me happy. Peter Jackson apparently is going to direct a new documentary, a new Beatles documentary based on like tons of hours of unseen footage from the Let It Be shoot. Hmm. And there's just so much about that headline that I love.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
like, all right, Peter Jackson, documentary, Beatles, Let It Be, unseen footage. I can't wait. So I'm just really excited about that.
Yeah. But all this obsessing over the Beatles is, you know, it's the opposite of letting it be. Why can't they just let it be?
It's true.
I mean, listen to the
really
song,
good point.
People.
Because it's fun. The Beatles are fun. They are the joy that we need in this world.
They're like the Seinfeld cast of music. Perfect combination of artists.
On the day they eliminate Inbox, I'll listen to Beatles to try to improve my mood.
All right, cool. Tell me how that works. Jeff Jarvis, buzzmachine.com. Jeff, it is always so much fun to get the chance to do this with you. Thank you so much. At Jeff
Jarvis.
Thank you,
Jarvis. Gents. Good work.
On Twitter. And I will talk to you soon. And then, Mike, this was such a good time. Fantastic. I'm so happy to be get here. The chance to do this.
I know your dog has an appointment. And you run out of
yeah, we'll see if I get there on time. It's not looking too positive.
But if I can just invite everyone to join us on one of our Gastronomat experiences. We were talking at the beginning of the show about how I travel.
Yeah.
One of the reasons we do that is we host a small group of people. We do amazing food stuff all day. We make wine, then we taste wine. We make cheese and we taste it. We bake, we cook, we learn. It's just really fun. Every minute is fun. We're doing it in Morocco, Mexico City, Provence, Prosecco Hills, and Barcelona. So I would really invite everybody to contact me if you're interested in joining us. Let me know that you saw it on Twig. And I'd really love to know. That's from Mexico City there.
All right.
Shoot me an email or go to gastronomad.net.
Gastronomad.net. And also, I don't want to forget, it's time for our yearly TWIT survey. We want to hear from you. We want to hear what you think about all the TWIT shows, how we can serve you better. So all you have to do is head over to twit.to/survey19 and you'll be heard. And we really appreciate it. You can find me here on TWIT. I do shows. Tomorrow, actually, Tech News Weekly. That'll be my next show. But always fun to get the chance to be Leo for a day on This Week in Google. Thanks for inviting me to be a part of the show. And thanks to Jammer B. Thanks to John for switching the show today and producing behind the TriCaster. We record live every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, 2100 UTC. You can find all the details about this show by going to twit.tv/TWIG. twit.tv/twig. There you're going to find all the back episodes. You can start from episode one and follow along week after week and see how Google has developed and how social media in general has developed over the years. And then catch up today and then write a report and let us know what you thought. That's it for this week. We'll all see you next week on another episode of This Week in Google. Bye, everybody.